From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Ledson. After his DUI, Aaron Snyder went to a treatment program where he thought he'd get help to kick his habit.
As we're pulling up, I take my last handful of pills and get out and walk in the door and check myself in.
But this program's idea of treatment was manual labor at the local chicken plant.
That's not recovery, that's a slave camp.
The people who run the program say they are helping addicts by giving them a job, even if they don't get paid for it.
If 40 hours a week is a slave camp, then America's a slave camp.
But many of the people sent to this program don't have a choice. Drug courts order them to go there instead of prison, even though state regulators tell them that's not how it's supposed to work.
I do what I want to do. They don't mess with me.
Coming up today on Reveal.
Every day, millions of people go online to search for local businesses. Does your small business show up in their results? When you create a website on WordPress.com, you make it easier for your customers to find you, to connect with you. Your business needs an online home. It needs a WordPress.com website. Come see why 28% of all websites run on WordPress, the web's most popular and most powerful site-building platform. Go to WordPress.com/reveal to get 15% off your website today. That's WordPress.com/reveal.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Ledson. One day 3 years ago, Cody Harper boarded a bus full of inmates headed to an Oklahoma prison. His addiction to prescription drugs had gotten out of control.
And I sat down and there was a black fella that was sitting right next to me. He said, "You know, you look like that Deputy Harper that busted me for cocaine down on the interstate." And I said, "I mean, this is right out of the gate. I'm going to another prison, you know, and I'm riding." And I said, "I don't know who you are. I don't know who that is. I'm sitting there trying." So I knew right then and there I was going to have a problem.
On top of the problem that put him on a bus full of inmates.
The smartest people in the world are addicts or alcoholics because they'll do anything to survive. Lie, cheat, steal, kill, you know. They'll do anything to get what they need. And I was one of them.
In 2008, he was working as a small-town sheriff's deputy. He was the deputy Harper his fellow busmate remembered. Then, Cody crashed his pickup truck and landed in the hospital with broken bones. He said prescription painkillers delivered his only relief. When he returned to work, he kept popping the pills.
You know, I would take 10 Percocets at a time and go out and work and actually enforce the law when I was more messed up than the people that I was dealing with, you know.
Cody remembers leaning over the bodies of people who had overdosed and taking their drugs. He even stole from the sheriff's evidence locker.
I had gun safes in there with enough narcotics to get Oklahoma City high.
He figured no one would miss them, but after one trip to the locker, he did a bad job of covering his tracks. He was arrested and soon found himself on the way to prison.
I was scared to death because I knew where I was going to run into people that I put there.
Around the same time, Oklahoma was trying to get a handle on its problems with prison and drugs. The state reports some of the country's highest rates of substance abuse and incarceration. Oklahoma's Governor Mary Fallon touched on that in last year's State of the State address.
Let's acknowledge the elephant in the room. Oklahoma's drug possession sentences haven't deterred substance abuse and have filled our prisons to overcapacity.
She urged lawmakers to stop locking up so many people for drug-related crimes and start referring them to treatment and rehabilitation. That's the kind of help a judge recommended for Cody after multiple arrests on drug charges. Instead of another spell in prison, he was ordered to a recovery center called CARE, Christian Alcoholics and Addicts in Recovery. Reveal's Amy Julia Harris and Shoshana Walter investigated CARE. The founders of the program say it's all about helping alcoholics and addicts. Turns out, it also benefits a major chicken company.
Yeah, we love it out here. We have 80 acres and, you know, the men get out and walk.
The founder and CEO of CARE, Janet Wilkerson, shows Amy, Julia, and me around the program's sunny green campus. We walk along a gravel path past a rose garden, a flagpole, and into a gleaming dormitory. It's lunchtime.
Hey, guys.
How are you doing?
Hello.
CARE is in a town called Jay, way out in the country, almost out of Oklahoma, in the northeast corner of the state. Almost 200 court-ordered drug addicts and alcoholics are here at any given time.
Janet says she wants these men to feel comfortable at CARE. Bible verses and her daughter's quilts decorate the walls. She thinks of her program as a ministry to society's outcasts.
I'm Mama Janet. I love to hug them and love on them because nobody likes them.
Court officials love Janet's program. CARE is strict and faith-based. It offers housing, meals, Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and counseling. And unlike most rehab programs, it doesn't charge its clients any money.
And that was one of the principal reasons that CARE was created as it is so that we can help more and more people that don't have the funds.
That attracted Aaron Snyder to the program. He's left it now. I meet him at his apartment about an hour north of Tulsa.
Julie Harris. Hey, Aaron. Hey.
When Aaron's parents first drove him to the campus, he had been arrested for his fifth DUI, and he was addicted to pain pills.
As we're pulling up, I reach in my pocket and grab some Lortabs and some Clonopin and take my last handful of pills and get out and walk in the door and check myself in.
Aaron hoped a year at CARE would help him turn his life around.
And you find out real quick, you're going to go to work. You're going to work hard. You're going to work hard for at least 40 hours for the rest of the time. You know, 40 hours a week for the rest of the year you're here.
Every day, men from the program work alongside paid employees at chicken processing plants right across the state line in Missouri and Arkansas. Simmons Foods owns the factories. It's a privately held company that takes in close to $1.5 billion a year. Simmons makes chicken products for KFC, Walmart, and PetSmart.
My job was to clean the room that they killed the chickens in, which had blood literally sealing the floor in it and chicken heads and stuff laying around in it.
Other men hung live chickens on a noisy, speeding conveyor belt, like this one in this industrial video. In refrigerated rooms, workers pulled out their guts, sorted the parts, and packaged them. The hours are long. The machinery and tools move fast and can cause injuries. Most Americans don't want these jobs, and CARE guys got the worst of them. Here's what three of the guys told us.
Oh, it's the most awful smell you ever. I mean, like, I wouldn't eat chicken for like 3 years after I come home. That's the nastiest place, the nastiest thing.
No one's ready for that coming in. It is horrible. I mean, because your muscles, your back, your knees, your body.
A lot of the CARE guys, they'll get treated like, you know, like they're scum or they're troublemakers.
More than chickens hung over their heads. If they were slow on the line or injured on the job, Simmons could fire them. The county drug courts that sent them to CARE could send them to prison. On top of that, the men in the program work for free. Simmons pays CARE in exchange for the labor. Janet says that money pays for the program. The workers get no wages.
That's ridiculous, man. That's not recovery. That's a slave camp.
Even under these conditions, Aaron got clean at CARE. He was one of the few who did. In 2014, CARE reported only a quarter of the men completed the program. But many of the men who did say it saved their lives. Janet doesn't dwell on success or failure, but on the reason she started the program. To serve men like her brother, who drank himself to death.
That stuck in the back of my mind that he wanted help so bad, but money was an obstacle. And that's where we are with so many of these men. Money is an obstacle. They don't have $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 to spend for a, you know, 30 or 45 day program. I mean, that was part of the goal, was to help men like my brother.
That wasn't her only goal. We discovered that when Janet started CARE a decade ago, she was a human resources executive in the poultry industry, and she moonlighted as a spokeswoman for Simmons Foods and other poultry companies.
After she had trouble filling the overnight shift at the chicken plants, Janet pitched her bosses an idea. What if she created a nonprofit that put addicts to work?
It was an easy sell. Simmons gets a cheap and captive labor force. It pays CARE a flat rate for each worker. If one of the CARE guys gets injured on the job, Simmons is not responsible for them.
Plus, the company can fire them for any reason, at any time, and it doesn't provide health care. That's different from the way Simmons treats its paid employees.
In her office, I asked Janet and Jim Lovell about that. He manages the CARE program.
Was CARE started in part to benefit Simmons?
No,
absolutely not.
They partnered with us because they want to help the alcoholic and the addict. And providing them a job is helping them.
We are such a small portion of Simmons.
I mean, I know.
They're a big company. We have a minute portion of their workforce.
And if 40 hours a week is a slave camp, then America's a slave camp, huh?
I know that compared to Simmons' entire workforce, CARE men are a very small portion of that. But they don't have to pay workers' compensation. They don't have to pay for other benefits. CARE is taking care of that, right? Mm-hmm. So are there benefits to Simmons aside from their helping addicts and alcoholics?
I'm sure there is. We're like a temp agency, and they hire through lots of temp agencies. And, it's a benefit to them. We're providing workers. But I will tell you, the benefit to the men is much larger than the benefit that Simmons receiving.
There are big differences between the workers from CARE and most Americans. People who work 40 hours a week get paid for it. So do defendants at some other rehabs that require them to work. The CARE guys don't. When most Americans quit or get fired from their jobs, they don't risk prison time. The way Aaron sees it, the men lose and the program and company win.
Work takes priority over everything. If it's work or counseling or work or classes, it's work. You're going to work. You know, they're scratching each other's back, that's for sure.
After graduating from the program, he worked as a dorm manager at CARE for a while, but he grew disillusioned and eventually left.
CARE's tax filings show that in 7 years, the program brought in more than $11 million, most from its contract with Simmons. Those filings also show CARE pays Janet about $112,000 a year to run the program. At any given time, the program houses a couple hundred men. Janet says that's hardly enough to run a factory.
Hundreds of paid employees also work at Simmons. But during certain shifts, Aaron says the assembly line depends on CARE guys.
You're talking about a plant that runs 250,000, processes 250,000 chickens a day. Some of those shifts, they were taking 2 or 3 15-passenger vans full of people to the chicken plant. You're talking 40 guys on a shift going to work at a plant. If CARE didn't go in, they'd have to shut the plant down.
The chicken company has repeatedly laid off paid workers as it brought on more and more laborers from CARE. Simmons even paid for CARE to build a new dorm, saying it needed more workers from the program.
We called Simmons to ask about this. Spokesman Donnie Epp says the company partners with the program to help addicts, not the other way around.
Is Simmons relying on CARE to fill that labor shortage?
You know, our goal is probably less about filling a labor shortage and more about finding the right people for the right jobs. And then also, believing in kind of the mission of CARE and the impact that they're having in people's lives.
Just as Simmons relies on CARE, CARE relies on the criminal justice system. Drug courts supply a huge number of the men who land in that program. Here's how drug court works.
To avoid prison, defendants must enter a guilty plea.
The judges require them to get regular drug tests, attend Narcotics or Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and hold down steady jobs.
Judges also order defendants to complete addiction treatment. And if they fail, they can end up behind bars.
In the Stevens County Drug Court, Sharon Kane tells the judge where he should send defendants for treatment. She's a big believer in CARE, in part because there aren't enough affordable treatment programs.
We used to have beds at inpatient places that was total treatment. They've cut the funding now, so drug court does not have beds that are paid for.
People wait as long as 9 months for the beds the state does pay for. At CARE, there's no long wait list. It costs the courts and defendants nothing. The program sends addicts away from the people and places that supported their bad habits. That's why Sharon uses CARE.
Generally, when I send people to CARE, it's to break ties with somebody in this county. It's to get them used to getting up and going to a job. So it's about making them grow up.
There's just one problem, though. A pretty big one.
We found out it may be against the law for drug courts like Sharon's to send men to CARE for treatment. Drug courts are only supposed to do that using facilities the state inspects and certifies. Those places emphasize mental health and drug treatment over work. Their medical and counseling staffs are fully trained.
CARE offers some services, but the program has never been certified, and most of its staff are not licensed. Because of that, when things go wrong, defendants have little recourse. Oklahoma requires its Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services to monitor drug courts and rehab programs throughout the state. But it can't do much if judges are breaking the law. All it can do is pull that drug court's funding.
Sharon doesn't seem to worry about that.
It sounds like you don't interact much with the Department of Mental Health.
But as little as possible. I do what I want to do. They don't mess with me. And I'm not saying that in a cocky way. They just know I'm going to do drug court the way I've always done it. If they come in here and start messing with this, the judge will shut drug court down.
At least 20 drug courts in Oklahoma send defendants to CARE. State law says drug courts must use certified treatment programs. Some drug court judges have found a way around that.
They don't say they're sending people with addictions for treatment. They say they're sending people there to give them work experience and stable housing.
But Sharon says you should look at the results, like Brandon Spurgeon. He was a defensive tackle on his high school football team before he went to work in the oil fields. There, he got addicted to meth. Sharon thought CARE could help him, even though it's not certified.
Brandon appreciated it. It made him grow up a little bit, too, which is good. Did y'all meet Brandon in person?
We did. When we showed up, he wasn't doing so well. He just had surgery.
Hi, Renee.
Hello, nice to meet you.
Come in. You still have the bands from the hospital.
Yeah, I took them off.
Brandon and CARE parted ways a couple of years ago.
He normally towers over 6 feet tall. His t-shirt reads, "Keep calm and date a big guy."
He's sitting in his parents' living room, slumped on a brown corduroy couch, chewing tobacco and grimacing in pain. His mom, Renee, asks if he's okay.
You need another pain pill?
Yeah, but if I do that, I'll be in her sleep.
Here's how Brandon got this way.
One night, he was working at the chicken plant when a metal door crashed down on his head. Almost 3 years later, slurring his words, he remembers how hard it knocked him out. There was blood everywhere.
Yeah, I know I laid up for about 10 minutes so I could stand back up. Everything, my whole shirt was covered in blood. My pants had overalls on. They were soaked through.
Right after he got hurt, doctors stapled up his head. Brandon says the accident damaged his spine. He suffered from dizziness and intense migraines.
They sent him back to work.
He went back to work before he did go back. Did you go back to the chicken ranch?
Yep.
Yeah, back to the chicken farm. He did go back to work there before they sent him home.
Brandon knew he needed more medical attention, but he says he was scared to leave, so he kept working. If he didn't, he could fail drug court and get sentenced to 15 years in prison. He got sober and graduated from drug court, but...
I wouldn't do it again. I'd rather go to prison than do that again.
Brandon says he'd rather go to prison than go back to CARE.
Today, he's in constant pain, and he can't hold down a full-time job. At 35 years old, Brandon depends on his mom and dad.
He has days that he just absolutely can't work. He's non-functional at times.
Renee, his mom, does give thanks that Brandon is clean, and his drug charges were dismissed.
Scared straight, heart straight, maybe, I'm not sure. So I'm not going to say that it didn't work.
Renee says CARE never apologized to Brandon for his injuries. The program pocketed his workers' compensation and that of other guys who got hurt. Renee is trying to make peace with all that.
And so even though we say, well, we didn't get this and we didn't get that, we have him. Sorry. We have him, but he came at a price.
Brandon's health and his independence.
That story from Reveals, Shoshana Walter and Amy Julia Harris. Here's something else they found out. Care might violate the U.S. Constitution. The 13th Amendment bans slavery and involuntary servitude. It does allow the government to use convicts for forced labor, but many of the people in the CARE program haven't yet been convicted of any crimes. Across the country, there are all kinds of programs that let people avoid criminal convictions and promise to get them help. But what happens when those programs don't fulfill those promises?
I thought it was a really good step at first, and then I had that realization that if I can't pay, then I'm not going anywhere in my life, and that means I'm kind of screwed.
That story next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Hey folks, Byer Duncan here. I work on Reveal's engagement team. That rehab center in Oklahoma, CARE, it isn't the only one that puts its residents to work for free. There are others like it out there. We're just not sure how many. No one is. So we want your help tracking them. If you have experience with a work-based rehab center, text REHAB to 63735. We'll send you a short form where you can share your story. Again, that's REHAB to 63735.
Finding great talent can be a challenge. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards with just one click. So you can rest easy knowing your job is being seen by the right candidates. ZipRecruiter puts its smart matching technology to work, letting qualified candidates know about your job within minutes of posting, so you receive the best possible matches. 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by growing businesses of all sizes and industries to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/reveal. That's ZipRecruiter.com/reveal. One more time, to try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/reveal.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. Like we just heard in Oklahoma, some diversion programs don't always help the people they're supposed to serve. Journalist Lee Romney has also been investigating diversion programs for Reveal. She's been in one herself.
I have. Dreaded traffic school.
Traffic school. After you get a ticket, it's a class you take on a Saturday afternoon to keep your car insurance rates from going up. There's even a comedy traffic school where instructors are stand-up comics who try to take the edge off.
That's how they get you in the door, but I went to one of those and it was like anti-comedy school. It was the joke was on us.
Oh, that sounds horrible.
It was
I'm
bad.
Sorry. Traffic school's the simplest form of diversion, and it's been around for decades. But now, courts and prosecutors are using diversion for a whole bunch of other types of crimes, from drug possession to trespassing.
There's actually bipartisan agreement that we've been clogging our prisons and jails, and people keep returning, and there's got to be a better way.
Diversion's also become a popular way to lighten caseloads for prosecutors, judges, and public defenders, because it channels people out of the system before they're convicted or sometimes even charged. For example, if you get busted for drugs, you might go into rehab. If you get into a fight, you might go to anger management classes. Finish the program, no conviction on your record. But just like private companies have moved into running bail bonds, prisons, and even probation, now they're getting into the diversion game. A lot of prosecutors love it.
It's pretty simple. It's appealing to prosecutors because they pay nothing. For-profit diversion programs are 100% offender-funded.
That's a sweet deal that can get even sweeter. Some companies like Corrective Solutions in Orange County, California, pay the prosecutor's office a cut for each offender who enrolls.
$50 a pop.
So that's their edge. They're able to come in and say, we're not going to charge you, and actually we're going to give you money. We're going to give you a kickback.
Some people call it that. The company calls it an administrative fee, or sometimes they call it return of prosecutor costs. But basically, they're making money from offenders.
So while prosecutors are getting kickbacks, the people who committed the crime have to pay for these programs. If they can't pay, they could end up with a criminal charge on their record. Now, the program costs from $350 to more than $800. Corrective Solutions tells prosecutors they'll offer breaks to people who can't afford it through a so-called indigent fund. Now, that sounds good, but those programs are paid for by charging other offenders more. And it's the company, the private company, that decides who gets the help.
It's a totally moving goalpost. It's not even really clear at all how you qualify. And I talked to lots of people who said they weren't even told there was an indigent fund.
That's what happened to 23-year-old Austin Greenwood from Sonoma County in the wine country north of San Francisco.
I needed some sort of program for my recovery, and I thought it was a really good step at first, and then I had that realization that if I can't pay, then I'm not going anywhere in my life, and that means I'm kind of screwed.
At the time, he was literally living under a bridge. Austin was addicted to meth when he was charged with possession of a meth pipe. On top of all of that, he had untreated bipolar disorder. He told all of this to his Corrective Solutions case manager.
She didn't say anything about any like grants or any way to help pay, or she just set a price and said, bring this much when you come in.
Under California law, the program for first-time drug offenders that Austin was in has to offer financial breaks to people who can't pay. We got data from the prosecutor's office that showed the company clearly wasn't doing that. All last year, the amount it gave out wouldn't have even covered the cost of putting two people through the program. To find out what was going on, Lee visited Thomas Johnson, the chief operating officer and general counsel for Corrective Solutions.
Are you Thomas?
Hi, how are you? Hi, Lee.
He's the son of the CEO. It's a family-run operation.
He did acknowledge that participants in the drug diversion program are often homeless. And he said the company knows the indigent fund isn't really working like it should.
Thomas says his company's testing a new appeals process for people who've been denied assistance.
I asked him to share the details of that, but he wouldn't.
A lot of this stuff is the secret sauce on how the program works. If we share all of the operational secrets, the trade secrets, then we're going to have our competitors picking up and doing the exact same thing.
Secret sauce? Really? I mean, it's a public program.
Yeah, it should be public sauce. I think
right.
That's
I
true.
Mean, we should all know what's in the sauce if the public is eating it, right?
Right.
Diversion isn't just about keeping offenders' records clean. It's supposed to address the reason the person ended up getting in trouble in the first place, by treating things like substance abuse or mental illness. Corrective Solutions pledges to hook people up with a whole bunch of services, drug and mental health treatment, food pantries, shelters, even educational services.
But I talked to people in three different states who said they needed help and they weren't offered any.
Aaron Robinette was one of them. We met him when he was 24 years old, living with his dad and brother in Pinal County, Arizona, between Phoenix and Tucson.
It was a house on the outskirts of Casa Grande, surrounded by alfalfa fields, super weathered ranch house with cow skulls all over the property.
Aaron had ended up with Corrective Solutions because of a marijuana possession charge. He had bigger problems too, a heroin addiction he explained to his Corrective Solutions counselor.
The counselor is not a trained or licensed counselor. In this case, his counselor was a Corrective Solutions employee who was a former cop. He didn't offer much to Aaron at all.
Aaron's counselor was mostly concerned with checking in to find out whether he paid his money, taken his drug tests, and attended his classes.
I was pretty much on my own through that entire situation. They didn't offer any counseling. They did not offer for me to attend a rehab.
About a month in, Aaron overdosed and landed in a psychiatric hospital. His family arranged for him to go to a treatment center in Tucson. He let Corrective Solutions know what was going on.
I had to seek rehab and hospitalization on my own. And when I did initiate it, they took that as failing to comply with the program.
Because he missed a check-in, they failed him from the program.
When Aaron got out of rehab, prosecutors charged him with a felony, that old marijuana possession charge. He landed a job, but he lost it as soon as the employer did a background check. The county prosecutor offered him the Corrective Solutions diversion program again, and he took it.
The second time I went through it, there was no drug tests in place. There was nothing like that. I mean, it's almost like they're giving me a free pass through the program to take my money. That's what it feels like.
He finally made it through the program, and prosecutors dismissed that felony case. In the end, though, Aaron didn't get the help he needed.
I'm really sad to say that he died July 26th at home at his dad's house.
He died of an apparent heroin overdose.
I spoke to his sister, Ashley Robinette, and she says there's no way to know if he would have done better if he had been offered meaningful services through the diversion program. But what we do know is that he wasn't.
They did not offer us one bit of help for Aaron. Not anything. That diversion program, it was useless and it failed my brother. And now he's gone. And he maybe wouldn't have been if they would have helped him a little more. I hope they can get a program in there that will help people to get clean, to find a job, and to begin living their life.
Lee tells us that a new Pinal County attorney took office this year. He ended the contract with Corrective Solutions after he reviewed some of Reveal's findings. His office is creating an in-house diversion program. To see pictures of Aaron and read Lee's reporting on diversion, visit our website, revealnews.org. Sometimes, the people who bail others out of jail can run into legal troubles of their own.
When I tried calling other bail bondsmen friends of mine, it was funny because I couldn't get through to anyone. Everybody was in jail.
When the bail bondsman goes behind bars, that's up next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. Hey, this is Al, and we wanted to take a break to tell you about another podcast that you might like. And this one I have a personal attachment to. I love this podcast because I love the guys who created it. I was there when they got started. I knew them as babies. They were such cute little babies. Aaron Henkin and Wendell Patrick, they're my friends, and they create this amazing podcast called Out of the Blocks. Now, in each episode, they try to meet every single person on a city block. They hang out, they listen, they record stories and soundscapes, and then they stitch it all together with an original musical score. The result is fascinating. It's a cinematic mosaic of humanity. Out of the Blocks. Check it out on Apple Podcasts, Radio Public, or wherever you listen. And be sure to let them know that Al told you to say hey. And now, back to Reveal. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letton. This hour, we've been talking about programs to keep people out of the criminal justice system that end up hurting the people they're supposed to help. Now, we're going to meet someone who is supposed to help people once they're already in the system. His name is Dino Garcia. He was a bail bonds agent living in Santa Clara County, California, home to Silicon Valley. Now, one day, back in August of 2015, he peeked through the blinds of his home and saw that he was surrounded.
Seven police officers in undercover cars parked in front of my house with a loudspeaker, guns pointed at me at 7 a.m. Mind you, I had my three-week-old grandson in my arm. So when I went to open the blind, a laser hit him. The laser was going slowly up to me, and I says, holy smokes, I thought I was dreaming. So I put the baby down, and I just walked outside. I says, and I already knew what it was about.
Dino was used to getting people out of jail. Now, he was headed there himself.
I did bail out. When I tried calling other bail bondsmen friends of mine, it was funny because I couldn't get through to anyone. Everybody was in jail.
Along with Dino, 30 other bail agents were arrested. It was the biggest bust of its kind in California history and the culmination of a year-long investigation by the Santa Clara County District Attorney's Office. But for Allison Filo, who was faced with a stack of 31 cases to prosecute, it was just the beginning.
As a prosecutor for 17 years working on some of the most serious cases in our office, I had no idea how little I knew about bail.
As he dug into the cases, Filo learned more and more about how the bail system really works. Today, you're going to hear evidence of those cases, too, through rarely heard phone calls between people behind bars and the bail agents who've got the power to get them out. Suki Lewis of KQED in San Francisco takes us inside the world of bail.
To understand why all those bail agents got busted, you first need to know what usually happens when someone gets arrested and brought to jail. There's fingerprints, a mugshot, mental health screening, maybe something to eat, and of course, a phone call.
Hello?
Because if you want to get out of jail, usually you'll need to call a bail agent like this one.
This is your first time being arrested for domestic violence?
Yes.
Okay. So usually first-time domestic violence, your bail will land about $25,000.
In this case, the defendant can post the full $25,000 to get out, if she has it. Money that she'll get back when the case is over. But if she doesn't have the $25,000, she'll have to go through a bail agent.
We charge you 10% to do that.
In return for that fee, the bail company promises to make sure the defendant shows up to court. That 10% the company keeps, no matter what happens with the case.
Then that secures your release as long as you go to all your court dates.
If you don't show up, bail agents are either supposed to find you or pay the court the full bail amount.
Is there somebody who can help you bail out of jail?
Calls like these are how bail agents make money. In Santa Clara County alone, bail companies pull in about $25 million in revenue each year. Nationwide, it's a $2 billion industry. The competition for this money is fierce. So bail agents like Dino Garcia take as many of these calls as they can.
Now, I learned a long time ago, answer your calls. No matter if you think it's bullshit or not, answer your calls because we all hope and want that big one, that $1 million, $10 million bail, because you never know.
Dino's a stocky guy with slicked back dark hair. He's always looking for the next deal, and he took hundreds of these calls a month.
My family could tell you to this day, I mean, Christmas, Thanksgiving, 3 a.m., my phone, I sleep with my phone. My phone was ringing all the time.
This call is from a correction facility and is subject to monitoring and recording.
What's up, kid? What's going on, dude?
Nothing.
What's happening, man? What are you doing, dude?
The relationship we have with inmates, some are built through years of trust over the phone. But, you know, you want to develop a rapport and relationship with inmates. And, you know, sometimes it entails, excuse my French, you're bullshitting, you're chopping it up. You want them to like you.
But in these calls, you can hear Dino's relationship with inmates crossing over from friendship to something else entirely.
Hey, well, what's up, buddy?
Hey, I was calling to see if I can still work for you.
So here's an inmate not calling for bail at all. He's asking Dino if he can still work for him.
Hell yeah, buddy.
Dino says yes, because what does this inmate have access to that Dino desperately needs? Guys that have just been booked and are looking to bail out, fresh clients. And Dino had a bunch of these inmates hustling for him, sometimes calling him 10 times a day. Here's Dino getting a call from another inmate.
Loco, ¿qué onda? I got a good one for you, Apple computer employee. Domestic violence, bail, $100K.
How long did you get for?
That's Dino asking.
He's just barely been in custody since last night. He went to court today, and he got his court papers, and it's $100K. He said he's willing to put up the 10 Gs.
All right, let me, what's your booking number and his name?
And what you're hearing right there, an inmate arranging bail for another inmate, that's called bail capping. It's illegal, and that's why these calls were evidence in a felony criminal case. See, California law says only the person who's been arrested, their family member, or their attorney can set up bail. The law is meant to protect inmates from exploitation. First-time arrestees can be really scared and just don't know how the system works. For example, there's a chance they could get released without having to pay bail at all. And it wasn't just Dino and his guys. There were dozens of inmates and dozens of bail agents working these schemes. One inmate recruiter made more than 1,200 calls to bail agents in just 5 months. Prosecutor Philo has listened to hundreds of these calls, where you can hear these recruiters working as middlemen, vouching for other inmates, and even negotiating discounts.
They were sort of the gatekeepers of bail, that they controlled access to the phones, and that they would actually manipulate or maneuver people into or out of certain housing situations so that they would have less competition for referring the inmates.
And how would they do that, like get people in different housing?
There's lots of ways in jail to get people in trouble.
I wanted to know how this whole thing worked from someone who was in on it, an inmate.
Hello.
Hi.
So are we recording right now?
So yeah, now we're still recording. Is that okay?
That's good.
So I tracked down this guy, Scott Culp, at Pleasant Valley State Prison, where he's now doing time for armed robbery. He was transferred here from Santa Clara County Jail, where he spent his days working for bail agents.
How did you get the inmates to go along with it?
They have no choice.
Scott says in the area of the jail where he was locked up, new inmates weren't given instructions on how to use the phone codes needed to make a call. So he'd help them.
And I take their code, I use their code, so they can't call, they're not able to call their family to have their family spell them out. They have to go through me and these spell bond agencies.
Bail agents compensated these recruiters in two ways.
They would send money. They would put money on my books.
By books, he means his commissary account to buy things in jail, like noodle soup, stationery, and shampoo. When he was transferred out of the county jail to state prison, Culp says he passed the business on to another inmate, and it was a pretty good business. Culp told me he made $15,000 in 1 year, but I have no way of confirming that, and Prosecutor Filo couldn't either. The jail kept no record of who deposited money into inmates' accounts.
You would think that you would have to show some identification or something in order to provide an inmate with commissary credit or phone credit or actual cash, and you don't. So they were able to freely give those sorts of benefits with no accountability or no paper trail.
The other way inmates were paid? With phone calls. To show you how this worked, let's listen in again to one of Dino's guys calling him.
This call will cost you no more than $3.11 for the first minute and 11 cents for each.
As you can hear, just initiating a call from jail can run you about $4. Calls are limited to 15 minutes, and the charges rack up fast.
To accept this call, press 0.
Dino accepts the call and the charges.
I just wanted to see if I can speak to my wife if you have time.
Yeah, hold on.
Dino agrees and connects him to his wife. That's what's known as a three-way call. Dino's picking up the charges for this inmate to talk to his wife. Three-way calls became a currency between inmates and bail agents, greasing the wheels of the bail scheme. But they also posed a threat to public safety. Prosecutor Filo says that inmates could make calls to set up new crimes, and law enforcement would have no way of knowing, because the only number that appears on the jail phone records is the bail agent's number.
And if the bail agent then uses his or her cell phone or her office phone and makes a three-way call to, for instance, that inmate's domestic violence victim who's protected by a restraining order, we would have no way to prove that that phone call was made.
When Filo told me this, I was like, wait a minute, because remember how each call begins?
This call is from a correction facility and is subject to monitoring and recording.
I had to wonder, were guards actually listening? And if they were, why did they let these calls continue?
How are you today?
Good, you?
I put these questions to Amy Lay. She's president of the union that represents correctional officers in Santa Clara County.
Like one of the inmates who was working as a recruiter for a bail company made 1,200 calls in the course of 4.5 months, which is like, that's a lot of calls all to the same number. And it seems obvious, like, okay, this guy doesn't need bail. He can't be calling for bail. But maybe, you know, why would that happen? Well, you know, why wouldn't that come to someone's attention?
We don't monitor how many phone calls it may make a day or a month or a week. We don't monitor that at all. The only time the department is monitoring the phone call if there is a active criminal investigations.
She told me there's one guard on duty for 76 inmates, and policing the phones just hasn't been that big of a priority.
And what about this issue of the three-way phone calls where it seems that the bail agents were compensating inmates by giving them free phone calls? How was that allowed?
The three-way phone call is not allowed at all. But it's very difficult if a person sits on by the phone and you know if they're going to make a three-way phone call or not, because you can't listen to their phone conversation at that moment.
Over the past 2 years, I've tried many times to get the Santa Clara County Sheriff's Department, which runs the jails, to respond to all the questions that came up in my reporting, like how inmates were able to control the phones, how jail staff could have been in the dark about this illegal activity, and was there any truth to claims correctional staff were actually in on the schemes? The Sheriff's Department wouldn't answer any of these questions. The next place I turned for answers was outside the jail, to the bail industry itself. How much did corporate bosses know about what their employees were up to?
We were taken by surprise by the arrests in Santa Clara County.
After many requests over the past year, I finally got a call back from Peter Boats, chief counsel for the biggest bail company in the country, Aladdin. 8 current or former Aladdin employees were arrested in the 2015 sting.
Our response to those arrests was to bring in an outside law firm that conducted an investigation. As a result of that investigation, we terminated 2 of the employees.
Did they come in to just to investigate these people, or did they come in to, like, investigate, is this more widespread? Is this happening throughout the company? Is this happening in other places in California?
No, they were brought in specifically to look into the allegations made in Santa Clara. However, as part of our own sort of internal review, we did a few things.
Boat says the company put in place an internal auditor to monitor the recorded calls from jail and proactively look for violations of the law. The line that I've gotten from most people in the bail industry is that the agents doing this were just a few bad apples. But remember, dozens of bail agents from 7 different companies were involved. Prosecutor Philo says her office actually had to limit the scope of its investigation. There may have been even more agents involved, but they just didn't have the resources to keep looking. And Philo says bail capping is not just happening in her county.
I think it's well known that it's happening throughout the state.
And beyond. In 2014, investigators in New Jersey reviewed calls from more than half the state's jails. They found bail agents were using inmates as recruiters in pretty much all of them. So far, I've told you about all the illegal stuff Philo learned. That the bail agents were using inmates to recruit new business, that the agents were paying those recruiters, and that a lot of this was happening out in the open. Now I want to take you back to something Philo said right at the beginning of this story.
As a prosecutor for 17 years working on some of the most serious cases in our office, I had no idea how little I knew about bail.
But these cases and these phone calls also opened her eyes to how legal bail deals are made. You might think once a judge sets a bail amount that that's a hard and fast number, but not quite.
So as long as you can convince a bail company to bail you out, you're out of custody.
Now, this point she's making is really important. Judges determine who is eligible for bail, but bail agents are the ones actually deciding who gets released from jail and on what terms. Not the judge, not law enforcement. And that convincing that Philo's talking about, it can sound like this.
Okay, I have highlights on 5-1. What do you want to know?
Booty.
Oh, and I have my boss size is 40BB.
Oh.
Here's a female inmate calling Dino to convince him to bail her out.
How much is your bail? $40,000? You're going to be my slave for a fucking month.
Yeah, I'll be all your slaves. Line them up.
You're going to do whatever I say, whatever I want?
Yes, of course.
For a whole month.
Dino told me he often joked around with inmates, talked to them on their own level. So we don't know if this woman got out of jail by making some kind of deal with Dino. But the thing is, nobody knows the final details of any of the deals inmates make with bail agents. They're private contracts, and they're never reviewed by a judge or a regulator.
You know, we're trying to get business. We're trying to help people out.
When I met up with Dino in a stairwell on the third floor of Santa Clara County's Hall of Justice, he'd just accepted a plea deal, 3 months in jail, and wanted to tell his side of the story. And I want to make a point about Dino here. He's in the story because he agreed to talk to me. Of all the agents who were arrested, his behavior wasn't even the most egregious.
I help everybody, and everybody bails.
When Dino says everybody bails, he's pointing out that fierce competition in the industry has created a buyer's market. A lot of bail companies offer arrestees, even those charged with violent felonies, zero money down payment plans. In essence, inmates can walk out of jail for free, but they can end up paying off their bail debt long after their case is over. I brought this up with Aladdin because they do offer these no money or little money down payment plans. Here's the company's business manager, Herb Mutter.
So there are payment plans, and those are on a case-by-case basis.
But then, so the judge sets the bail amount, but then the bail agent decides how much money the person has to pay to get out of jail. They decide, they make the release decision.
We went back and forth on this a bunch of times, with me asking how bail deals like this protect public safety and how this is good public policy, and Herb saying, we're doing our job. We're making people show up to court.
They make the decision on whether to post a bail bond or not, right? And once again, the bail bond is guaranteeing the appearance of the individual in court.
Right, and that's it.
That's what the bail bond does, yes.
Aladdin's chief concern is making sure the person shows up to court, because if they don't, the company stands to lose a bunch of money, right?
I think everybody understands that the concept of bail is that someone puts money at risk to ensure that a defendant will appear in court. And it is shocking how infrequently that business model actually occurs.
Now, Aladdin says they do pay the court when a defendant skips bail, but wouldn't tell me how much or how often. Philo says what she sees most often is not bail companies paying out to the courts or bail agents returning people who've skipped bail, but law enforcement picking up those same defendants and booking them back into custody. About a year and a half after Dino and the other 30 agents were arrested, I went to the final hearing in the cases. 22 agents in total accepted plea deals, with sentences ranging from community service to 4 months jail time. No inmates were charged.
Hey, so was that it?
That's it.
So good.
I caught up with Philo on the street outside the courthouse. She was headed back to her office, wheeling her giant stack of case files.
What's your overall impression?
I mean, my overall impression is that it will make some impact in the industry. I do hope that at least the prosecutions themselves will cause people to pause when they're engaging in criminal activity as it relates to bail. Yeah.
And these cases have changed Philo, too.
It has been an extremely eye-opening experience for me.
As a prosecutor, she's argued in court for high bail amounts countless times. But this year, she testified before state leaders that California's bail system needs drastic reform in order to keep defendants accountable and to protect the public.
That's Suki Lewis of KQED in San Francisco. California lawmakers are considering a bill that would significantly limit the role of for-profit bail companies. Suki tells us that other states, including New Jersey and New Mexico, have already reformed their bail systems, but there could be nationwide changes. Federal courts are considering whether cash bail means poor people end up staying in jail unfairly in violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. Catherine Miskowski was our lead producer this week. Cheryl Duvall edited our stories on diversion programs, along with managing editor Andy Donahue, with help from Jennifer LaFleur. Mia Zucker-Candle edited our bail bond story. Jim Briggs is our lead sound designer and engineer. He had help this week from Catherine Raimondo and Kat Shuknet. Original music and mixing this week by Ramtin Arablouei. Amy Powell is our editor-in-chief. Suzanne Reaver is our executive editor. Our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan, and our theme music is by Camarado, Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reeve and David Logan Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Letson. And remember, there is always more to the story.